Good afternoon, everyone. By a show of hands, can I see who has had hands-on personal experience using SoundScan before? Oh my gosh, okay, most of you. Great. So maybe this will be a little pass. So I'll be focusing specifically on reportable diseases and how we have automated daily analyses in New York City. So we have a real need for automated cluster detection at the Bureau of Communicable Disease at the New York City Department of Health and Mental Hygiene. We are responsible for monitoring and investigating more than 70 reportable diseases for an at-risk population, including 8.5 million residents, and we are awash in data. We receive more than 1,000 reports every day from providers and laboratories, mostly through electronic lab reporting. So we need computers to help us prioritize resources for case and outbreak investigations and response activities. So I'm hoping at the end of today's session, if you don't already, I hope you'll be able to describe the basics of how the prospective spacetime permutation scan statistic detects clusters. I hope you'll be able to appraise and select analysis parameter settings and have some comfort in modifying analyses as needed to improve cluster detection. So this will be a methods talk. So the prospective spacetime permutation scan statistic is one of the probability models available for download in SASScan, which is freely downloadable. So we have used this probability model to set up automated daily analyses that have run every day since February 2014 for about 35 of our reportable diseases. And one of the great features about this method is that it simultaneously tests for clusters of any size at any location, imposing no artificial boundaries, which is in contrast to some other cluster detection methods in use that are, for example, purely temporal techniques. Another nice feature of this method is that it requires only case data, no detailed underlying population data. And it accounts for purely spatial variations in disease occurrence. So if there's a part of the jurisdiction that is consistently high or low in disease occurrence or diagnosis or reporting, that's not something that's going to cause a signal every day. Similarly, the method implicitly adjusts for purely temporal patterns, such as a citywide seasonal effect, long-term secular trends, or day-of-week effects. So we've adjusted for purely spatial and purely temporal patterns, so what we're looking for is spatiotemporal patterns. And the method also accounts for multiple testing of all of the possible clusters being evaluated. So to give you a heuristic sense of what's happening, so imagine each of these dots is a census tract, and our question is, are there excess cases within any particular census tract or set of census tracts? So we then ask, are there more cases observed than expected inside versus outside the circle? And then we repeat that for all possible circles of varying radii centered on each of those census tracts. So far, this is a purely spatial analysis. There's no temporal component. So let's add time as a vertical axis. And now we are creating space-time cylinders where the circular base represents space and the height represents time. So for each spatial location, we have multiple observations over time. And we generate these space-time cylinders to scan for disease within. So then we need to compare the cylinders. We use a likelihood ratio-based test statistic to compare the number of observed versus expected cases inside and outside each of those space-time cylinders. And when I say the expected number of cases, that expected number of events is a function of two things. One is the case count in the circle during the baseline period, and that is how the method accounts for purely spatial patterns. The other component of the expected number of events is the total count for us citywide during the time window of interest, and that is how the method accounts for purely temporal patterns. So we compare these cylinders, we identify the cylinder that has the maximum likelihood according to this test statistic. We perform inference by generating random replicas of the data set. So this is where the permutation in the space-time permutation scan statistic gets its name. We do this by shuffling the dates that the cases occurred and assigning them to the original case locations. And we use Monte Carlo hypothesis testing to compare the most likely clusters in the real versus the randomly generated data sets. and we assign a recurrence interval, or RI, to the clusters. And this has a formal definition, which is the number of days of daily surveillance required for the expected number of clusters at least as unusual as that observed cluster to be equal to one by chance. So just like a p-value has a very formal definition, so does a recurrence interval. But approximately, the higher the recurrence interval, the less likely a given cluster would be expected to occur by chance alone. And the user needs to set some sort of signaling threshold. So for us, for reportable diseases, we have set a threshold of 100 days. Another reasonable choice is a year. But this is an important component of setting up a prospective analysis. This is the list of the 37 diseases that are reportable to our bureau that we run daily analyses on. So you can see it's a wide variety of etiologies and modes of transmission. So these were selected because we believe that timely automated cluster detection could inform programmatic activities and lead to public health action. We also believe that this method might be useful for monitoring additional diseases that have outbreak potential, including some of the sexually transmitted diseases or vaccine-preventable diseases. They're just not reportable to our bureau, so that's why they're not listed. So we run one analysis for each of these diseases. Of note, for Salmonella, we run separate analyses by serotype, and for Shigella, we run by species, so separately for Sonii and Flexneri. And then some diseases, the people who are responsible for investigating them have told us that clusters within young children are of particular interest. So in addition to running an analysis for all ages for these highlighted diseases, we often run an additional analysis restricting to less than 5-year-olds. And similarly, we recently introduced a separate analysis looking at invasive group A strep disease, just restricting to school-age children because that was also considered to be of particular interest. So some of the nuts and bolts of how we make this happen. So it requires a couple of input files. One is a geographical coordinate file. It's a text file. For us, we do our analysis at census tract resolution. There are about 2,200 of those in the city. And so this coordinate file just has three columns. It has a census tract ID and the X and Y coordinates of the centroid of each census tract. You could also use latitude and longitude. And we also have a case file that has four columns, the census tract. We have one row per case, the event date, and the day of week. And I'll talk more about the specifications that we've adopted for running this analysis. So a little bit more about why we aggregate our data to census tract and how. So the spatial unit that we use is census tract of the residential address at time of report that we usually get from the electronic lab reporting. And our disease surveillance database, which is MAVEN, is integrated with a custom geocoding web service. So as diseases get reported to us in near real time, we get several geocoded geospatial elements available for each case, including the census tract, and that's what we use. So of note, the less that data are spatially aggregated, the more precisely that areas with elevated rates can be identified, so it's a signal-to-noise issue. So in contrast to some other sort of cluster detection techniques, you really want to use the smallest geographic resolution that you have available. For the date of interest, we use something that we call the event date, which is our best approximation of the onset date. So if we have the onset date available, that's what we use. If not, we use the diagnosis date, typically defined as the collection date of the first specimen that tests positive. So what we're trying to do is define our clusters according to when the cases became ill. But onset date is missing for cases who have not yet been interviewed, and we can't use non-missing data for time when we're doing a spatiotemporal analysis. So the best available proxy for onset date that we have, we use. For the study period, we use 1 year for most of our diseases. We believe this to be a reasonable choice. What we're trying to do is balance the need for a period that's long enough to establish a stable baseline for each spatial unit, yet short enough to avoid variable secular trends, such as like a geographically different increase in the underlying population of a spatial unit, because we're not including population denominators. It's a case-only analysis. For case inclusion criteria, so we use all reported cases, regardless of the current status. So depending on the specific reportable disease, a case might initially be assigned a transient pending status, that upon investigation, that case may ultimately be reclassified as a true case, confirmed, probable, suspected, or ruled out as not a case. So the reason we include all case statuses is we're trying to preserve timeliness, regardless of whether the cases will ultimately be confirmed. And it also keeps the inclusion criteria consistent across the study period, which would avoid a bias towards false signaling. We also include a day of week variable. So I mentioned that the analysis adjusts for purely temporal patterns, including day of week effects, but it does not implicitly adjust for day of week by space interaction. So this would mean accounting for how the daily pattern of health-seeking behavior and diagnoses might vary geographically. So we do a day of week adjustment. So similarly, we also have to think very carefully about each of the parameter settings for the analysis. So for timely cluster detection, we are performing prospective analyses. I think later you'll hear about retrospective analyses. So when I say prospective analyses in this framework, that means that we're evaluating only the subset of possible clusters that encompass the very last day of the study period. And then because we're trying to detect acute, ongoing, localized disease clusters, we're performing space-time analyses, again, rather than purely temporal or purely spatial analyses. The space-time permutation probability model has several advantages over other probability models that are developed for count data, including requiring only case data, and also not requiring the assumption that the probability of being diagnosed and reported as a case is independent of location of patient residence. So, for example, the Poisson probability model might have that assumption, and that assumption is often violated in actual public health practice. For disease cluster detection, we are scanning for areas with high rather than low rates. And we run our analyses daily using data at daily resolution. So we're evaluating all of these possible space-time cylinders, but the user does have to set a maximum spatial cluster size being evaluated. And the option that imposes the fewest assumptions is to allow the cluster to expand in size to include up to half of all of the cases during the study period. It's possible to force the clusters to be smaller than 50% or to restrict in terms of geographic size by setting a maximum circle radius, but that can be arbitrary and can lead to selection bias in the types of clusters that you're detecting. So we use this default setting. Similarly, it scans for clusters of all possible lengths, but you do have to set a maximum temporal cluster size. We believe that 30 days is long enough to encompass most cases involved in point source clusters, which typically span a few days or weeks depending on the pathogen. 30 days may not be long enough for diseases that have very long incubation periods, or if you're in a situation with extended propagated transmission, or if there are intermittent common source outbreaks. The user also has to set the number of Monte Carlo replications. It has to be at least 999 for adequate power, and then because we're trying to minimize computing time across all of the diseases being independently evaluated each day, we don't use a higher number. Also a note on secondary clusters, which is you can choose your setting on as an output parameter. So there could very well be multiple active clusters at any moment, so secondary clusters should also be reviewed in addition to the primary first most likely cluster. And then you can choose how to define your secondary clusters. And we define it as no cluster center in another cluster. And other options would be no geographical overlap or more geographic overlap, but we believe that this option allows us to evaluate secondary clusters that have some geographic overlap and works well. Okay. So the meat of how we do this is a SAS program that every day it generates SAS scan case and parameter files, reads in our geographic coordinate file, invokes SAS-scan in batch mode, reads the analysis results back into SAS for further processing, and then if there is a cluster that exceeds the recurrence interval threshold that we set, we generate notification emails to the people who are responsible for responding for that disease and also our bureau's leadership, and also produces summary reports for clusters. And all credit to my co-authors, Deb Capel and Eric Peterson, who worked for a very long time to develop this program and maintain it. And when I say automated, the way that we've actually been able to automate it is we have a designated computer that is set to automatically run the SAS program each morning before open of business using Microsoft Task Scheduler. So a little bit of results of how it's been in operation. So our signal frequency is pretty low. During a one-year period, we observed 28 unique signals across 15 of the 35 diseases being analyzed. And this was perceived to be a reasonable investigation burden for our staff. This is not a lot of signals considering the volume of reports that we receive. Not every signal was actionable, but the people who are receiving this output were interested in being notified of these clusters, even if not ultimately actionable or verified as true outbreaks. But we do have a few success stories, the most dramatic of which was this. You may have heard that New York City experienced the second largest community-acquired Legionnaires' disease outbreak ever in the United States last year. It's a really interesting outbreak story. If you'd like to learn more, I encourage you to attend this session tomorrow being given by our graduating EIS officer. So the way that this outbreak was first detected was by SASCAN. Before any human noticed that there was an increase in reporting, SASCAN alerted us. And here is the actual raw SASCAN output that I'll walk you through to show some of the issues I've been discussing. So the signal occurred on July 17th of 2015, and you can see that we're running prospective spacetime analyses looking for clusters with high rates using the spacetime permutation model. I mentioned we use a one-year study period and that we have about 2,200 census tracts. And over this time period, we had 288 cases. SASCAN is telling us that the most likely cluster is centered on this census tract, and here's the list of all the other census tracts that are included. An alternative way to represent the spatial extent of this cluster is here with the coordinates and the radius. So this is the x and y coordinate of the centroid, and here's the radius in feet. And I mentioned that we're only looking for live clusters that are active through the day before the analysis is run. So the analysis was run on July 17th, so we're looking for clusters that extend through July 16th. And it's looking backwards, and it says the most likely cluster started on July 9th, and there are 8 cases observed during this time period, and their occurrence interval is 1.4 years, so very unlikely to occur by chance alone. So our SAS program takes some of the raw SASCAN output and converts it into this type of output, which is a little more user-friendly. So it has cluster summary information. It also produces this map that has the spatial extent of the first most likely cluster and any secondary clusters, and it shows the actual locations of the patient residences of the cases that provoked the cluster. We also have another example of a Legionnaires' disease outbreak that was first detected using SASCAN in the last year, and this is in a different part of the city in Flushing, Queens. And on May 7th of last year, this analysis detected 4 cases that occurred in 2 days. So this is to make the point that SASCAN helps us link even very small numbers of excess cases to outbreaks. And this was another outbreak that warranted a public health response. And it works for diseases other than Legionnaires' disease. So it's also effective for diseases like shigellosis, which are spread by person-to-person transmission. So on November 14th of 2014, we detected 9 cases over 25 days. Shigella is not a disease where every case report is routinely investigated, so it was only by running this analysis that we were alerted to this increase in cases in a timely way that allowed us to do an appropriate public health response, where we promoted appropriate hand washing in daycares and preschools in the affected community. So now I want to shift gears and explain. So if you have a system like this up and running, what's in your toolkit if it doesn't work very well? Like if you have false signals, you have delayed signals, you have missed signals, what can you do to improve your analysis? So one thing that you can do is modify your recurrence interval threshold. So you might need to increase your signaling threshold if you have too many false signals. And similarly, you would want to lower your recurrence interval threshold if your signals are delayed. And this is a judgment call. So if there's some event that happens in your jurisdiction and there's heightened public concern or political will, that might shift the balance between early detection and false signaling. There's a trade-off, but this is something that needs to be continually evaluated. There are also several types of situations when you might need to modify your case input file. So if you have false signals, that once you look at the line list of cases that are driving the signals, you might realize that, oh, there are some events that actually don't meet the case definition after all. And this happened for us, where we had several false signals for Legionnaire's disease, where we were including disease reports where the only positive laboratory test was an antibody test that did not meet our case definition, so we revised our case input file to exclude those events and the false signaling stopped. Similarly, we have had to recognize when we're getting Shiga-toxin-producing E. coli reports where the only lab report was a culture-independent diagnostic test. Again, this doesn't meet the formal case definition, so we excluded those events and it stopped the false signaling. Also, to recognize there's something you can do about it if you're receiving delayed notification of signals. So one example that we had is we're only analyzing the patient's home address, but we had an outbreak that also affected the persons who were working in the area. So by ignoring that geospatial information, we were late to the party. So the way we address that is if the patient's home address is unavailable, and one reason that might be unavailable is if they reside outside of our jurisdiction but work inside of our jurisdiction, then we swap in the patient's work address, which we obtain after patient interview. And another option, which we've also done, is generate an entirely new case file just of work addresses, so you can look for clusters in work sites. You also can modify the case input file when you're missing signals entirely. And one important cause of this is that if you have outbreak cases in your baseline, that makes it harder to detect a new outbreak in the same area. So thinking about Legionnaire's disease, if you have nosocomial clusters in your baseline, it's appropriate to exclude from your case input file the specific outbreak-associated cases, identify them, and pluck them out. In contrast, for community clusters of Legionnaire's disease, it's more appropriate to exclude all cases through the whole jurisdiction during the outbreak period, and that will fix this, this missed signals problem. Another important reason why you might be missing signals is if you're not using the smallest possible geographic unit. So if you're using a larger unit like zip code or county, then your signal-to-noise ratio, it might wash out the signal. You can also modify your study period. Sometimes you might want to lengthen your study period beyond 1 year. So if you have decided to use a very long maximum temporal cluster size, then it's appropriate to extend your baseline. Or if you're tracking a prolonged outbreak, like the shigellosis outbreak I showed, it went on for so long that the outbreak shifted from the maximum temporal cluster window into the baseline period, distorting the location of where the current outbreak was. So we lengthened the study period so that the ongoing outbreak constituted a smaller fraction of the whole study period, and that fixed this, strange signaling that we were getting. Similarly, there are also times when you'll want to shorten your study period. An important time you would want to do this, if there is some sort of change in your surveillance system so that your recent and your older data are just not comparable. So then you just restrict your study period to after whatever change in surveillance happened so that your study period is internally consistent. And I'll wind down by showing three kind of fun analysis variations that we've implemented on the space-time permutation scan statistic. The first is there's actually a way that you can use multiple addresses per person in the same analysis, and we just set this up a couple months ago. So this shows actual output from a signal we got last month where we detected 3 cases in 7 days, where one of the 3 cases was a work address and 2 were the home address. And this was an extremely weak signal of just very low, 32 days, did not require any public health response. But the way that this works is that the case is considered as observed inside the cluster if any of the case's addresses fall within the cluster. And just to show you where this is in SATSCAN, on the input tab, there's an advanced option where you can include the location ID in the scanning window if at least one set of coordinates is included, as opposed to only allowing one set of coordinates for location ID. So that's a fun trick that we recently learned about. Another one is that we've executed a multi-focused cluster test. The purpose of this was to assess clustering of Legionnaires' disease cases specifically centered around cooling towers to help prioritize environmental sampling and to identify the most likely cooling tower. So in addition to the case file and the geographical coordinate file I mentioned, this requires a third input file, a grid file, and this has the X and Y coordinates of every building that we know about that has a cooling tower. And here we assess all possible clusters centered on these buildings. And here's a good reason why you might not want to use a maximum spatial size of 50% of the population at risk. Here we're looking for highly focal clusters around cooling towers, so we restricted the maximum spatial size to up to 1 kilometer. And basically the output is a list of buildings ranked by recurrence interval. So I mentioned that we had a very large Legionnaires' disease outbreak last summer. There were 2 cooling towers that tested positive by PFGE for the outbreak strain. Incidentally, this output shows, I believe, a feature that will be discussed more in the next talk about how SATSCAN now automatically can produce KML files, so it's really easy to visualize the clusters, a great enhancement over times past. So there were 2 cooling towers that tested positive by PFGE, and this multi-focus cluster test told us that cases were more strongly clustered around cooling tower A. They accounted for more of the cases, a longer portion of the outbreak period, and they had a higher recurrence interval, less likely to occur by chance alone. And later, whole genome sequencing confirmed that only isolates from tower A were indistinguishable from the patient isolates. So this was a nice example of how we used epidemiologic data and environmental and laboratory methods to help triangulate a cooling tower source. And the final neat trick that I'll share is that we use the space-time permutation probability model to actually conduct purely temporal analyses, and we do that for Salmonella serotypes. And the reason that we use the space-time permutation as opposed to a purely temporal analysis is we're interested in being alerted to increases in the proportion of all Salmonella cases that are of a particular serotype. And I mentioned that the space-time permutation probability model adjusts for purely temporal trends. So it adjusts for the overall seasonality of Salmonella across all the serotypes and only flags serotypes that are above and beyond the general seasonal trends. And the way that you do that is you replace the census tract, the concept of space, you replace it with serotype, and you set the maximum spatial size to approximately 0. So that's another neat trick. Okay, so once we had it up and running, the main challenges that we've experienced are really about data quality and they're technical. So in order for this to work well, we need up-to-date data in our surveillance database. So that means we need to minimize the number of disease reports that are still pending data entry at the time the analysis is run every day. So that means we want to minimize our telephone and fax reports. Once our cases are interviewed, we want to quickly enter the work address and the onset date. We also need cases to successfully geocode because we're using the census tract. If they don't geocode, then they fall out of the analysis, which makes it harder to detect a true cluster. So an example of why cases may not geocode is if they are reported as only having a PO box, or if they live outside of our jurisdiction, or if there's any typo in the street address. So we have to continually review our data and correct these typos. And we also need to make sure that our cases are up to date on deduplication, because if you have, you know, 2 cases, 2 reports that are actually the same person, that'll appear as an increase and you'll get false signals. So we have to stay on top of our data quality. That is really the biggest challenge. There are also IT challenges. I mentioned that we have this scheduled to run on a designated computer, and sometimes IT pushes out updates and there are forced computer reboots, which interferes with our daily run. But more substantively, we have to continuously maintain electronic lab reporting for all of our laboratories, even when they're transitioning to meet meaningful use requirements, in order for this to continue to work well. And there are also some interpretation challenges. So when we generate a cluster, keep in mind that this suggests only approximate spatial and temporal boundaries. It's not the gospel. It's going to include some background cases. It's going to exclude some outbreak-associated cases. So it's one tool among many to help define an outbreak zone and figure out what's going on. But I am really proud of the system we have in place, and I think some of the reasons it works well are that we have a very strong informatics infrastructure, key to which include electronic lab reporting and automated geocoding of our patient addresses. These surveillance methods are powerful and effective, and our staff are wonderful. We have dedicated analysts to develop and maintain the system. When we produce signals and send them to subject matter experts, we have knowledgeable epidemiologists who are interpreting these signals, and to have adequate outbreak investigation resources to do something once these signals are brought to our attention. So I think this can complement other outbreak detection methods that you might have in place, and this concept can really be useful for any health departments who are receiving more reports than they can manually review in near real time. So I'll close with some resources. So this first paper is the original method paper that describes the specific probability model. The SAScan user guide is really useful. And the work that I described today, unfortunately it's not yet published, but we are trying to get it published. It's currently under review. Once it's ultimately published, we will include an online technical appendix that has detailed sample output, the line lists that we produce, and also all the underlying SAS code, which hopefully will make it easier if you're interested in adopting it for your jurisdiction. And I'm the corresponding author, and feel free to reach out to me with questions. So I think we can take a few questions now.
George Berbelin, the Missouri State Health Department. Thank you for a really great accomplishment. I have two questions. This all requires a huge computational power. How you handle that? Because so many diseases, and you have to run Monte Carlo simulations, and this happens overnight, and then you have results in the morning?
Yeah, so it's not a problem. We don't have a special, you know, like this is a regular desktop computer. Many of our diseases have low case reports, and the process will terminate if there's no cluster identified. So it doesn't have to do all 999 simulations if there's not actually a cluster. So I think the time that it's scheduled to run on the computer is something like 4 or 5 a.m., and it's always completed long before open of business. So computational issue for the way that we've structured it is not a problem.
So you just use one computer?
Yeah.
And the second, regarding the determining the size of the cylinder, what parameters you use, what guides you determining the size of the cylinder, and then you mentioned you adjust the seasonality. What is the baseline that you use to adjust for seasonality?
Okay, we use a 1 year, oh, this is in the case input file. So we use, under study period, we use 1 year for most diseases. And we believe that's reasonable to establish stable local baselines for each disease. And then you asked about the maximum temporal and spatial cluster size. Is that your question?
Yes.
Yeah, so the maximum spatial cluster size is 50% of all cases during the study period. This is the option that imposes the fewest assumptions. And then the maximum temporal cluster size can vary by disease, but it's 30 days for most of our diseases.
And then you mentioned in special circumstances you can change all that.
Yeah, and so, I mean, I could give examples of when we have changed them. I'm not sure if that's of interest. But yeah, so we have it set up so that when I say that the SAS program generates case and parameter files every day, it's because we have a file that reads in the analysis parameters, and so we can very easily modify any of these parameter settings, the length of the study period, the recurrence interval threshold, the length of the temporal window, and we do that to address problems and signals that we've had or because our subject matter experts have requested modifications.
Thank you.
I was curious if you've done any QA against retrospective clusters that were found through case finding, et cetera, et cetera. First, I'm really excited that you guys are doing this work. I think it's terrific that somebody's using this technology. I was really excited to see this group of presentations today. But one thing we tried in Massachusetts was looking at some old clusters that were identified through our department. I imagine it was against those that were found through SASP. I was wondering if you could address that in any way.
Yeah, when we were trying to determine our analysis parameter settings, which was more than 2 years ago, so I'm struggling to remember all the details, but we did have a couple in mind, and we ran the analysis as if it were that day, where, like, the problem is for reportable disease data, there's lots of lags, and it's not clean. And so, you know, if you're pulling from your live surveillance database, it's much cleaner if you try to replicate analysis 3 years after the outbreak versus how it actually is in real time. So we believe that our best proof of concept was to actually implement it and get it up and running. So we did a little bit of that, and it worked well, I think we modified some of our parameter settings based on that, but I think the proof is more in the pudding of whether it actually runs. There's been so many manuscripts that are proof of concept, like, if we were to implement this and run it, you know, it should work well. And I feel like, yes, there's been enough in the literature that says it should work well. Let's actually implement it.